Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mona, we've talked on the show before about lawsuits, particularly suing the federal government, as if it's a silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems. But when is a lawsuit not a good idea in EB5? And particularly, what about private lawsuits against developers?
That's a very good question, Mark, because it's not always a good idea to have a lawsuit. And we are seeing more and more coming up in EB5. I'm talking about private lawsuits, not lawsuits against the government. I want to make sure that everybody knows that we're not talking about WOMs right now. These are private lawsuits. And don't forget, EB5 is a lot of money. And we're talking about $500,000 for an individual. If it's a lawsuit, for example, if it's an agent who might be owed money for maybe 10 investors, or maybe we're talking about another third party who wants to come in. You know, typically we are talking a considerable amount of money. And most often as well, there's a lot of other emotions involved.
Yeah, sorry to jump in, Mona. You're right. There is a lot of emotion, a lot of money and a lot of emotion. So this is a very sensitive topic. And to help us explore that topic, we have joining us Jason Gottlieb. Jason is a partner in Morrison Cohen's Business Litigation Department, as well as the chair of the White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Practice Group. His practice focuses on regulatory enforcement, litigation, and arbitration related to securities, EB5 issues, cryptocurrency, commodities, future and derivatives, as well as structured finance. Jason, welcome to EB5 Investment Voice.
Mark, thanks. It's great to be here. And Mona, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
You know, Jason, we are seeing a lot of litigation going on in EB5 right now. I'm not talking about litigating the government. I'm talking about the amount of litigation which is happening within projects, regional centers, friends and family. Are you seeing this type of thing?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, particularly in the last year, we've seen a lot of projects get stalled out, a lot of things downturning in the economy, which creates, of course, a lot of people waiting for money and wanting to get their money back. Adding to that, the fact that the government's just processing people's visa applications and granting them or denying them, people want to get their money back out of these projects. And if they can't get it out for any factors, people are very quick to the trigger to want to sue to get their money back.
Yeah, I should give a little background to that, because when EB-5 first began, most of the time it was very normal for your money to remain in escrow until your 526 was approved. But back in the day, you could get a 526 approved within 2 to 3 months, so a project could easily wait. Then USCIS started increasing their adjudication times, and then we were looking at 1 year and 2 years. And then, you know, projects just couldn't wait, because if they had to wait a couple of years, they just didn't want that EB-5 money. So now what's happened is that the money has been deployed into the project. And if for some reason somebody wants their money back out prior to the project being at the stage where it can repay, this is where we are starting to see quite a considerable amount of litigation.
Absolutely. People get impatient. If they've been denied, if they've been accepted, if they've just changed their mind and they want to go a different way, they want their money back. They want to move on. And for a lot of people who are investing in EB5 projects, $500,000, that was the old threshold, of course, it's a lot of money for a lot of individuals. So they want to get that money back. And if they can't, then they go to a lawyer and the lawyer says, let's go to court, let's sue. And it's not always a good idea.
No, exactly. And I think this is really what the purpose of this podcast was. We wanted to bring out the information here so people realize, when is it to sue or not to sue? That is the question.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to dig in for my Hamlet quotes. I don't know. I didn't know there was going to be a test.
Okay. All right. So let's actually start with the real figures, the cost. Typically, Jason, if you're suing, and you're going to be suing usually in federal court, or maybe I should ask you, would you sue in federal court? Would you sue in state court?
like every other answer every lawyer will ever give you, the answer is it depends. You know, rule number one is it depends on what the contracts say. And you have to look to read what the contracts say. They're going to set where you're going to be. Are you going to be in a particular state? Do you have a particular governing law? And then after that, you have to remember that the federal courts can only take cases in specific instances where they'll have jurisdiction, either subject matter jurisdiction or diversity jurisdiction. And those things may or may not actually exist. So you may have a choice, but you may not have a choice. You may be stuck in either federal or state.
And for the layperson who's listening, federal court is usually a lot more efficient and faster than state court, correct?
I think that's generally true, although it very widely depends on the judge. And B, some states have commercial courts that are a little bit quicker and more efficient, but it generally depends. You also have to understand that federal courts have judges who are picked by the president and are appointed by the Senate. And state courts can be people sometimes who are elected by voters, sometimes are picked in back rooms, sometimes other methods. So it can be a bit of a guessing game as to what judge you're going to end up with in state courts.
Right. But usually our experience has been that a federal court judge is more familiar or has more knowledge on areas relating to immigration and especially EB-5.
I think that's true. Immigration matters tend to be federal jurisdiction. So that goes to the federal courts. And a lot of these EB-5 projects are essentially, there are securities laws issues, and issues of securities laws tend to be in the federal courts as well. So when you're going to be going to court and you're choosing complex areas of law involving federal areas, then federal court seems like the better bet.
Even before we even get into whether or not people should sue, what is the average cost of suing when you're going into federal court?
Without saying
it depends.
we'll just assume that that's the beginning of every single answer right from now on.
Hey, it's all good if you give us the factors it depends on.
The cost of suing can be quite high. Just to file a complaint can cost easily $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, obviously, depending on the lawyer that you've selected. And filing the complaint is only the first step of the case. There's still a long, long way to go. So going through a full federal court litigation can be quite costly. And unfortunately, when the amount at stake is the $500,000 that's tied up in the project, it has to really give you pause to ask yourself if you want to spend half of that, three quarters of that, or all of that just to have a shot at getting that $500,000 back.
Yeah, that's actually very, very true. I have found that many lawyers are not well-versed in EB-5, many of the lawyers who are taking litigation cases on, and some of them haven't even read the offering documents, the PPM, and understood the whole point of the at-risk investment.
Well, Mona, in that case, are the clients literally paying for those legal inefficiencies while the lawyers educate themselves?
I think that's a good question. You see, Jason is a little different from your average litigator because Jason deals with EB-5 litigation. Litigation in the sense that he understands how EB-5 works and he's very familiar with lawyers who don't understand. Right, Jason?
that is true. Look, the law is a complex beast and each sub area of the law is itself complex. So, you know, if you're looking for a lawyer in any particular area, you do want to find a lawyer who has done that before, because otherwise, you're right, part of the expense is paying a lawyer to come up to speed on what can be a very complicated area of the law.
So getting back to the actual case at hand, most projects will have had properly constructed documents, which are quite watertight. And those watertight documents really don't allow people to just take out their money when they want, because again, that goes against the whole principles of EB-5.
That's exactly right. One of the principles, as you're saying, is that the money has to be put at risk for a certain duration, and it has to remain at risk for that duration. The EB-5 program doesn't let you just withdraw your money like you can from the ATM whenever you feel like doing it. As a result, sometimes people get impatient, they want their money back, but they haven't read the documents. And the documents can be very clear. They cannot get their money back until certain thresholds or triggers that have not yet been met. And in that case, it can be very frustrating for them. I can feel bad for them. It's a lot of money that they can't get. But the documents that they've signed simply say they can't get that money back yet.
The way EB-5 is structured, an investor isn't filing individually. He's part of what's called an NCE, a new commercial enterprise. And that new commercial enterprise either makes a loan to the project or it is part of either preferred equity or common equity. That makes a difference when we are trying to sue, correct?
That's exactly right. And it makes differences for a number of reasons. First and foremost, an individual investor is not a lone wolf. The money that they're investing gets bundled up, as you've said, through the NCE to a project. So coming in and saying, well, I want my money back, you have to think about all the other investors as well, because they all have money in the project. And if any one or two or five or 10 investors could say, well, I want my money back now and get their money out of the project, then the project may not have enough money left in it to actually get finished, get developed, get built. And that's what is necessary to do to repay everyone. So there is a bit of a collective action problem here. Everyone has to be bound into the project, and typically they are through the project documents. Because if any one or two or five or 10 people out of whatever number of people are in the project, if any number could leave, then it would endanger the project and everyone's investments in the project.
Mm. So here, who would you be suing then? Would you be suing other investors? Would you be suing a regional center? Would you be suing a developer if you wanted your money back from a project?
Again, it depends, on who you think has done the bad thing that is causing you to not get your money back. And here there could be various theories of the case. If a lot of money went into a project and that money went to the developer and the developer said, hey, everyone, thanks for all this money. I'm going to retire to Hawaii, buy myself a fleet of Teslas. See y'all later. Bye. In that case, you're going to be suing the developer who stole all the money.
Right.
But if the money is in the project and the developer is being responsible and working on the project and building things, and you're just impatient and you want your money back, who is it that you're trying to sue? Who is it that you think you can get your money back from? And frequently people will say, well, I guess it's the partnership or the entity in which all this money resides. But effectively, people would then be suing a partnership that they themselves are a partner in.
Right. So then the manager would oppose, the manager who might be the regional center would be one party. And then are you suggesting that the investors may be other parties?
That's exactly right. And sometimes we've seen inter-investor squabbles as, you know, one or two or five people want their money back, but the other five or 10 or 50 or 100 people say, hang on, you can't get your money back. The documents say you can't get your money back. And if you did get your money back, it would endanger my investment. And if it endangers my investment, it could also endanger my application for a green card. So you'll have investors fighting amongst themselves over who can get out or who has to stay in.
Yeah, that makes sense, Jason, because you don't want one person or a few people jeopardizing the intents of all. So that makes sense.
It does. I'm going to ask you, Jason, so in such a situation, I know that USCIS doesn't allow projects where they believe money is not at risk. And if you are giving money back willy-nilly, then perhaps they would see that the money is not at risk. But often we get individuals who come to us and they're very confused as to what a class action is versus an individual investor. So could you just explain, please?
Sure, absolutely. Some people think that a class action is just, well, we've got a big group of people and that group of people want to sue. But that's not quite right. A class action is where one person or a group of people are going to be lead plaintiffs and they stand in for the whole. In that case, all of the people who are going to be in that class have to be similarly situated. So if one investor thinks that he should get his money back and decides to bring a class action, and all the other investors say, well, wait a minute, no, you shouldn't get your money back. That's going to endanger the process for all of us. It's hard to see how a class action could succeed because the person bringing it does not actually stand in for the whole. He's not similarly situated to anyone else. So that's a very different dynamic.
Most big projects have private placement memorandums, and that the PPM, the offering documents, they list out a lot of the risks. And we have found that so many times the offering documents, the PPM, have saved the developer because the risk is already outlined. But what about when we have disputes between friends and family, which we're seeing a lot of, and there is no offering document and there isn't any, you know, PPM? What does the court look at?
Well, in cases where there are offering documents or PPMs that provide disclosures, what that does is it gives fair notice to investors that there could be risks in this project, right? The construction might not go the way it should. They may not get what they want out of the project. And as you know, many of these PPMs have pages and pages and pages of risk factors. We were quoting Hamlet before. I guess Polonius says that brevity is the soul of wit. And I will say that I have yet to see a PPM that is particularly witty.
Well, or a PPM where they don't use font 8, a single spacing, so you can't even read it.
It's no Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So you have a different dynamic, as you said, with friends and family, or when you have a much less formal arrangement. Somebody may say, sure, I trust my cousin. I'll put in $500,000 because my cousin says it's a good deal, but they do not have all of those risk factors. That can be particularly dangerous for a lot of the people involved. The investor may not understand all of the risks, may not understand what they're doing. They're investing just based on trust. And the person who is soliciting an investment without making those risk disclosures can get in some pretty hot water as well, because they have essentially solicited an investment without disclosing what all of the details of that investment will be. And that's going to be problematic, I think, for both sides.
So in that case, I suppose we can't emphasize enough how important something like the operating agreement is.
Absolutely. It's really important to have good, solid project documents for everyone to know what those documents say, because those will govern. If you go to court and you say, this is what I want, the judge is going to say, first question, what do the documents say? Because those documents will provide the guidance for everyone. And if you come into a project because your friend told you so, and you've loaned this money and then it's going to disappear, you may not have a lot of recourse if you go in and the judge says, what do the documents say? And you say, I have no idea. What documents? What are you talking about?
Yeah. Say, Mark, this was something that we were discussing with the previous podcast with Rohit.
Right.
The problems with friends and family.
Yeah, exactly. That was only 3 months ago. And I'm hearing a lot of the same thing, is like, your friends and family are your friends and family. But yes, go ahead and document that friendly relationship and what you all expect out of it. Otherwise, you fall into what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
We could just keep rolling with the Hamlet, neither a borrower nor a lender be, for loan. For loan oft loses both itself and friend. There's some wisdom there.
Yeah, there actually is. But let me ask you, what about the current situation, say COVID? So we have a project. Let me give you an example. We have a project where they're ready for repayment, or they would have been ready for repayment, but for COVID, and COVID is hampering, if not really hurting, and a couple of investors being impatient decide to go and sue. What would a court likely do in this situation?
We're seeing a lot of cases, both in EB-5 and outside EB-5, where COVID has wreaked havoc with all sorts of contracts. A lot of contracts contain clauses where a certain action must be performed within a certain time. And of course, COVID and the government restrictions around COVID have made performance of those contracts impossible or impracticable. In some cases, when it truly is impossible, people have been able to get out from under the contract. If you were, you know, required to host a wedding in a big crowded hall, and a government has come along and said, sorry, you can no longer host a wedding in this big crowded hall, then you will likely be able to get out from under that contract because of the government action. There's a so-called force majeure clause that endures in most contracts.
Right.
That said, sometimes there isn't, or sometimes it doesn't quite fit into the contract. So what about a construction project that is just taking a little bit too long? What about a business venture that is very heavily reliant on money from tourism or other kinds of activities that have been depressed during COVID? In that case, it's hard to know where the line is between something that is an act of God, a force majeure that would cause cancellation of the obligations of the contract versus, well, you know, business has been bad and it's not your fault, but that's tough and you still have to comply with your end of the contract.
Are you seeing alternative resolution coming in, like arbitrations, maybe mediation?
We have seen that happening for a lot of the COVID-related negotiations that people have to have. I mean, just from a very basic point in the spring and summer of 2020, every company that was renting office space was renegotiating with their landlords. They weren't allowed to be in the office space, so they would have tens of thousands of square feet in Manhattan, very expensive rent,
yeah,
but they literally could not make use of it. I think in this case, a lot of the landlords realized if they try to hold out for all of the rent, there would just be a default, it would be a court action, it would be months and months or years before they would be able to see it. So you saw a lot of informal dispute resolution, from, you know, rent reset arbitrations to just the most informal dispute resolution, picking up the phone, trying to hash out a deal and seeing what people could do.
Yeah.
We are seeing this start to play out in the EB-5 industry as well. And I think that we're going to see the litigation reverberations from COVID echo across the next couple of years.
I can't agree with you more. I think that the litigation is only just beginning. It's a shame, actually, because EB-5 has become so litigious that we are seeing that. But that, I suppose, is a consequence of having people with lots of money.
Well, you know, that's true. I mean, we sometimes joke that we see litigation in two instances, either where people have a lot of money or where people don't.
Wow, Jason, you have such a wealth of information, but may I ask, who do you typically represent? Do you represent the agents, the individuals, regional centers?
I've represented all three of those and even other kinds of players in the EB-5 space. Really, very often it's a question of who happened to call me first.
So you have seen this play out from all angles. And I think if you could give some advice now, some real advice, I know you're a litigator, you make money from suing, but if you could give some real advice to somebody who was considering a lawsuit against one of these players, what would you say?
I will tell you, even at the cost to myself, you should probably think very carefully before paying a lawyer to file a lawsuit. Because people don't understand, I think, when they get into these lawsuits, how much, not just money you're going to spend on the lawyers, but the time that it takes, the emotional investment that you have to put into it. You can't just hire a lawyer and say, okay, my lawyer is going to take care of it and walk away. You have to become partners with that lawyer and work with them to give them all the facts, to give them the background. And it's a long process. It's a slow process. It can feel like a torturous process. And to be honest, a lot of litigators, because we do it every day, day by day, we lose sight of that. And we forget how tough it is for the clients to be involved in this process, particularly when you're talking about EB-5. If you've got a visa on the line, it's not just money. It's about something very personal to you.
Yeah.
And to be cliche, it can be about the American dream. And that's a really personal thing that you have to grapple with. It can be difficult to go into that emotionally, especially over the sustained periods of time that it takes for any one of these lawsuits to play out. So when people come to me and say, should I file a litigation? Should we sue? As much as it's in my personal financial interest to say, yes, pay me lots of money, let's go litigate, I have to counsel people very carefully to think about this, think about what they're getting into. So if they decide to do it, they're doing it for the right reasons and they're prepared for how difficult it can be.
You know, you're absolutely right. It can be very emotional because often we're talking about people's life savings. And to continue the Shakespearean theme, you know, they really want their pound of flesh. So
wait a minute. We've jumped into a different play now.
See, I was going to quote Shakespeare by saying, I wasted time and now doth time waste me.
And you're in a different play now. We got to focus out here, people. Let's at least stick to the play.
So. Just getting back to the point, because it really is a very serious and it's a very real point. And I know from dealing with so many individuals right now that a lot of people are considering lawsuits. So I thank you, Jason, for giving this real sincere piece of advice and coming on the show and explaining what really happens and what suing a regional center or a project could really mean.
Absolutely. Mona, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.